extremely large radio company in the United States that has in their position 10 or 15 anechoic chambers, probably 25 antenna engineers working in those chambers. The head of the department and I were having a one-to-one conversation. And I asked him, do you know how a dipole works? And I gave him my philosophy and I gave him that diagram. And I said, this energy is flowing down the transmission line, it hits the dipole, turns the corner, what happens next? And he said, why the hell would I want to know that? I told him that because of the 5,000 kinds of antennas, almost all of them have a dipole hidden in there somewhere. All your antenna engineers and all of those anechoic chambers are impedance matching dipoles, day in and day out, when they adjust your antennas for the right VSWR and the right bandwidth. Let me drop them. So all those antenna engineers working for you, including you, better know what's going on inside of a dipole, otherwise you're wasting time, wasting resources, wasting money. To which he said, yeah, sounds right, I'll get back to you on that. He never did. And there's a whole lot more to that story. W2LYY, K2LYW in the tech man.
I have a question for you, but I'm going to be very polite. You can put it at the end of the space report, because they should take their turn first.
Because I'm curious, just tell me what the subject matter is going to be, Joe.
You're a scientist. You're always curious. It has to do with television decoders. Digital television decoders.
Maybe now's the right time. You've got one of the experts on that subject on the east coast of the United States, who is the chief engineer for Channel 21 and Channel 13, PBS television. I'm talking about Eric. You've got one of the digital television experts sitting here listening right now. Why don't you pose your question? I don't feel like waiting. Over to you, Joe.
You sure it's not going to be getting in the way of the mailbag or the space reports, right?
We're going to go through your subject for the first 10 minutes. Then we'll cut it off after 10 minutes, go to the mailbag and the space report, and then come back. Police will... We'll find out. We'll get the tip of the iceberg in that first 10 minutes. Go ahead, Joe. Wait for the beep.
Try to talk right over there.
Because it's very interesting how that's coming in.
That's either 37, that's looks like 375.
Not coming from 375.
Sound good, then, Joe. Go right ahead.
I'm looking at the frequencies here. It's not coming out of the out of where it's supposed to be. Anyway, okay. If you answer my questions quickly, with a very quick answer, and I have a series of very quick questions, you'll be able to get to the subject matter very quickly. Can you do that?
I'll try. I'm usually not that brief, but I'll try.
If you're not brief, you'll just prolong the whole thing. Okay? Here goes. Imagine you have a television decoder, brand doesn't really matter, but in the case of what I use, it's an insignia. And say, if it receives a signal level of minus 65, it's as happy as can be, 65 dBm, that's 75 volts approximately, and as happy as can be, and it can reproduce a picture of what it sees into your television receiver. Okay? Got that?
Got it.
If the signal drops to minus 90, it cannot reproduce your television picture anymore. Got that?
Minus 65, yes. Minus 90, it probably says weak signal.
Okay. In the case of these three transmitters producing energy on RF channel 28, RF channel 33, and RF channel 38 coming off of Empire State Building, because of them feeding two antennas at the same time, and the antennas are competing with each other and causing an interfering type of pattern, we talked about this before, measured at a distance, you get a scalloped type of pattern, where if you look across the 6 megahertz of energy, it's supposed to be spread out across the TV channel, as you go like 1.25, maybe 1.5 megs or so, each time you go there, you'll find a dip in that signal level. So you may be in a 6 megahertz span, you have two or three dips across that. You got that so far?
Sure do. I'm going to assume that scallop pattern is like a 2 or 3 dB of peak-to-valley ratio because of funny effects at the transmitting antenna and the environment between there and you. Over to you, Joe.
Negative. See, you started going to the lower explanation. You can't do that. You'll just screw things up. The difference between the peak energy on the channel and this dip that you see is approaching 20 to 25 decibels in change. That's what's seen and measured on distance on all three of these channels. Got that so far?
Boy, that's a lot. And that must drive that poor digital converter crazy. Go ahead.
Tell you why.
Okay, here's part of the question. Apparently the digital converter can put the little symbols, as they're called, all back together and give you a viewable television picture. Okay, it is capable of doing that, but in doing so, it must lessen its sensitivity to that particular frequency as far as looking at bit error rate and or whatever. And I think what happens with interference, this is where the question comes in, if you had this type of effect happen, and you had a band opening, and you had another RF channel coming from elsewhere in the country, up or down the coast and or whatever, and it started to approach even half the signal level of your peak signal you're getting out of New York City, and filled in the scalloped part of the patterns with this other energy from elsewhere, would that cause the thing to fall on its face quicker? There's your question.
But that signal with the scallops is a lot more vulnerable. Eric, 20 dB of peak to valley or whatever it is, that sounds like an awful lot. You seem to know where that's coming from. Give us some words on that, Eric.
Well, a couple years back, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, they decided they didn't have good coverage in Brooklyn. So they put up this thing called a backfill antenna. And it's fed by a T that comes off the antenna line. And one goes to the one that's mounted up on the wall in there. The other one goes to this one that's kind of aimed at Brooklyn. I don't remember what the angles were, but there's a couple angles there. If you happen to be on the south shore of Long Island, in the middle, or into the ocean, or some place in Staten Island, you get to see the same station create its own interstitial distortion. And that's what this scalloping is. Now, you know, you guys are looking at it on spectrum analyzer. You've never seen what it looks like on an oscilloscope that's pre-tuned and amplified. The actual waveform is interesting to look at. And there's something called trellis. Let's go up for a second. The trellis is a numerical code that kind of helps decode it. There's 8 different levels of VSB. And from that, you actually try and create the block signal that will decode the IMU and IMU station. The fact that you are seeing a distance station fill in those holes, and do it quite accurately if you were to look at it on a scope or expand your spectrum analysis, you may find that the edges are perfectly locked with each other because they're all being driven by the same source, which is the GPS operator that is looking at the satellite. WRW, can you do that?
I'm guessing, Eric, that the problem is that the fill-in antenna is a good number of feet below the main antenna aimed at the horizon. Therefore, those two antennas on the exact same frequency, on the exact same data, by their spacing, are a kind of vertically displaced interferometer that's making a whole bunch of vertically displaced fingers in space of antenna pattern, resultant antenna pattern. And when you sweep that in frequency, those fingers are sweeping across your receiving antenna, so to speak, and you see these peaks and valleys. I am guessing, let me drop this. If this was the best of all worlds, the original antenna on top of the mast, instead of having one simple elevation pattern, pancake pattern aimed at the horizon, would have a slightly broadened pattern vertically down low to do in fill-in. If the fill-in had been designed into the main antenna, therefore the fill-in component and the real component out to the horizon would be co-located. They wouldn't be X number of wavelengths apart that's making this vertically displaced interferometry pattern. If this is the best of all worlds, that antenna with that pattern would have made this problem go away. I wonder if any of the really smart broadcast stations have ordered the antenna pattern that way, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. You seem to forget some very important factor in all of this, and that is, how did that antenna get there, and when did that antenna get there? And, as you know, way back when, in the years beyond this, some smart guy at CBS signed a 99-year lease with the Empire State Building. So when the World Trade Center went bye-bye, guess who was transmitting VHF from the Empire State Building? And it just so happens that, you know, this is at the time that we're just really starting up digital. The digital transmitter went bye-bye, and it's time to get some digital up. So they got whatever antenna was sitting on the shelf.
And because of the failure of the World Trade Center, and therefore New York City broadcast had to be put back on the air, and Atlantic and Alpine, New Jersey was not doing a good enough job, at least for the people on Eastern Long Island.
Do a good job for anybody.
I'll take your word for it. Alpine's a beautiful looking installation, just wasn't in the right place with the right hardware. Did the antenna on World Trade have that nice fill-in pattern? Is that how World Trade kept the people under the umbrella in Brooklyn happy, as well as the people way out in Southampton? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
Well, consider this, okay. Most broadcast antennas usually go someplace high. That means up. As pretty much standard in all broadcast antennas, you usually get your choice of 1 degree or 2 degrees of down tilt so that you can cover down what's below you. And depending upon the license and the result of the little survey that is done and the, my brain is coming up with the right name. If it's that electronic survey of what your grade A and grade B is, you may require a specific type of antenna. There's a particular pattern. For example, WLIW, there's really no need for me to stick anything into the Atlantic Ocean and really put it up in Connecticut. So the kind of pattern that this transmitter has is sort of a peanut if you're looking at it. Because trying to make the most efficiency, but being in the city that you're on top of World Trade, you want to make the best of the circle as you possibly can.
Yeah, everything I know about antennas, particularly when it comes to the so-called shovel-shaped antenna pattern, cosecant squared antenna pattern that they design into radar antennas, in order to not get that null off of the main lobe, so that you could fill in for signals. When an airplane flies straight overhead for radar, there's a little bit of the antenna pattern intentionally put there so that the signal doesn't fade out. So I know that there are design techniques for antennas that would give you a pattern that's broad enough, low power side lobe, so to speak, broad side lobe, to give you the fill-in for the people nearby. That could have been designed into the antenna had it been demanded at the time of purchase. Yet,
you know, you're talking about time here, being off the air X number of days and getting back on the air, you know, all the rigging and all that other stuff that goes with it.
Oh, yes, I understand that. The antenna that was on World Trade, you had to take, you could have taken your time to design that antenna. Did that antenna have the shovel-shaped, did it have the Cosecant square pattern we're talking about, Eric? Go ahead.
Okay, you have to break that up into a couple of different parts because as they went digital, the antenna system that is there, which was designed by Vendom Odin, who passed away, he was the main antenna engineer for RCA, and he created this phenomenal antenna that sat on top of the World Trade Center. And when we went to digital, we literally had to open it up, take some plasma torches, cut the old stuff out, and put some new stuff in. It was really cool. The pattern was pretty much a flower, and it didn't have any one particular strong lobe. It was pretty even across the board, and we measured and plotted a number of times after we put together. And these were the UHFs, the VHFs. They're all deltas and bat wings and turnstiles. They're all pretty cool, but don't forget that one point in each direction.
Okay, you called that a flower pattern after you did the torching of that antenna. Is that the azimuth pattern, I presume, and the elevation pattern? Did it have the fill-in capability that you didn't need an auxiliary set of antennas down low like you've got on Empire? Over to you, Eric.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. It also had an interesting, I guess, over the horizon sort of looking globe to it.
Very nice. So under certain propagating conditions, people far away got a signal from you, I guess you're saying. So, yeah, the technology is there to design the antenna we need in order to pay for it, get it delivered, and get it installed in Empire today. That would almost take an act of Congress, wouldn't it, Eric?
Well, as a matter of fact, unbeknownst to you, that actually is in progress right now. The auction has begun. And the way it looks is they're taking another 125 megahertz, so the highest channel is going to probably be around 31. That's interesting. You know, right now the highest channel is 50. We lost that last segment, the last auction round. The government will have to actually help people change towers, change antennas, change transmitters to fit into the new scheme of things when the FCC places you at whatever frequency they desire. Control WK3, Jack.
So of all the television, Advanced Television Selection Committee, ATSC type, televisions coming from Empire today, I think you're telling me the majority of those people are going to be moved to new frequencies. As such, they have the opportunity to do a redesign of the antennas and, in theory, to do it right. Is that what you're saying, Eric? And I presume the branding will stay the same. Channel 21 will still call itself Channel 21, even though they might be on a new frequency. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
What happens with the receiving converters?
Reference what you're talking about?
I didn't hear what we said there, but that's a possibility if they don't sell the frequency. You know, actually, they expect to have it all done from the end of the auction when things are finalized. It's all going to get done for every TV station throughout the country that remains on the air, because quite a few won't be on the air anymore at the end of it. They expect it all to get done by then, and that's a lot of money and a lot of time, and there aren't that many power crews that are really certified. applies to work on broadcast towers. We're not talking about people with the cell phones. We're talking about big towers. Big things, big antennas, lots of money. H-R-W's being too, yeah.
When those same branded television channels, like Channel 21, Channel 13, and so on, keep the same brand, but they're going to be moved to new RF frequencies, it's not a big deal when it comes to your digital television receiver. You just do a rescan, and it finds that new channel, is what I believe. I'm also guessing, Eric, that the major motivating force for all of this is that the cell phone companies, for instance, are demanding more frequency. We want the 5G handheld devices to have 1 gigahertz, 1 gigabit per second of uplink and downlink. It's one hell of a goal. I think that's the major driving force. Is that true? KE2EJ? K2RIW?
K2RIW, KE2EJ. No, the driving force is actually the past chairperson, actually the past two chairpersons, and the current chairperson is the FCC, who actually have been, all three have previously been the president of the NCCA, which is the National Cable Television Association. By the way, this is a very biased opinion here. And their desire to see broadcasters just go away, get off the planet, so that way we can collect money from everybody that wants to watch television. Or at least that's one thing. But there's also Congress is behind it, and the ka-ching of the past offices have brought that's really driving. Now, I know somebody that works for one of the larger mobile carriers, and they're just having enough trouble with the noise for 700 megahertz. We'll wait till they see what they're in for when they get this new stuff. K2RIW, K3J.
Broadcast by way of radio or television has existed now for roughly 100 years. There's roughly 100 years of tradition that over-the-air RF broadcast is receivable by home receivers, and at least in this country, we don't pay a tax to do that. Yes, in the United Kingdom, they pay a tax, and that supports their BBC. To take that 100 years of history, where everybody who owns a receiver can get free of charge over-the-air broadcast information, to take that away and to try to force that all into cable-like or satellite services, boy, there's going to be a lot of people that are going to gnash their teeth.
You left out cell phones.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of people that are going to be unhappy about that. I'm certainly one of them. I'd like to believe the people who are going to be unhappy with that will eventually demonstrate enough gumption, enough congressional power by way of your senators and representatives and whatever. I'd like to believe that over-the-air television broadcast, although it may be minimized, I want to believe it's never going to be disappearing. I've been hearing every 5 years that it's going to disappear in 5 years. We've been hearing that now for a long time. I'd like to believe it's never going to happen. Make a guess, Eric. What's the probability that over-the-air broadcast of radio and television is going to cease in the United States? I want the answer to be no. K2EJ, K2RIW, on paper it.
K2RIW, K2EJ.
Now, you know, there are things like there are areas of the country that absolutely require some method of alert. Tornadoes and severe weather alerts and things of that nature. As much as that, the FCC has forced the requirement of those types of alerts being presented to you on your cell phone, it doesn't take into account failures and interconnection between cell phones, where the power can go down, they lose power, lose connectivity, and none of those nice fancy gadgets work. But yet, the broadcast facility that has its own backup generator that can get the information out. So, no, I don't see it ever going away, but I see it. It's been reduced, and it's being reduced again. That's not to say that it's going to be reduced even further when we go to ATS-3, and instead of needing 6 megahertz, you can do the same stuff in less than 3 megahertz and get some really quality results and have it play on your iPad and your cell phone and whatever else you got. XYW K2K.
Okay. Somebody had some further comments on this one before we go over to the next section of the TechNet. Give me a call letters right now, K2IW.
It was me. I was talking to Mr. Druckmann the other day, and he says he mentioned something to me that within 10 years' time, all of the stuff above 470 is going to go bye-bye. All communication stuff, which like in New York City is all NYPD, fire services, EMS, and other various things that are up there, all going to go bye-bye within 10 years. So say you put three more television channels down there, you throw off all the other low-power stations off the air, you still don't have enough room for everybody to play in the sandlot. How do you solve that problem?
Hey, give us a couple more words on this one, Eric. I mean, Joe, if everything above 470 is going to disappear, are we going to force all of those two-way radio services, fire, police, and whatever, all to be below 470? Is that what they're saying?
No. No. They're going to get off the frequency from 470 going up to probably 520. Which is in some parts of the United States is a current business band in different segments. They are going to go up into 700 meg digital part of the spectrum for a lot of communication services. So if you take those channels, say in New York City, there's only three or four spaces you can put more TV channels from 470 going on up. Even with what you're saying, if they take care of all the TV channels above 31, RF 31, in New York City, somebody's going to lose. You still don't have enough space to put all those remaining transmitters and to keep everybody happy.
RF channel 31, if I did the math correctly, starts off at 572. Is everything going to be squeezed into 572 to 578, I'm going to guess, is channel 31. Is everything going to be squeezed into 31 and lower when it comes to digital television, Eric? Is that what you believe is in the process of starting to happen? And if so, how soon? KE2EJ, K2LIW?
K2LIW, K2EJ. That's not what I believe. It's what is happening. Actually, we won't know exactly how much it's going to be reduced until the end of the first round of the auction, and then people accept or reject the bids that are given to them. When it finally gets whittled down, we'll see how much actual bandwidth will be made available. So, you know, all those numbers are subject to change at this point.
Right now, the lowest channel, I think, is 51. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, 51 is actually an SDA. It's a leftover from the last auction, and actually, you know, from what I gather, T-Mobile is anxiously awaiting them getting off the frequency, because that's past the end of the TV band as it stands right now. You know, after this next round of auction, we'll see how much it all gets squeezed down. By the way, even if the public service people move and clear off that part of the band between 470 and 512, which I doubt will happen, especially in New York City, there's just too much stuff. You know, we've got, I think, there's a 17, you can't do 19, you can't do 18, you can't do 14 or 15, or 15 of it. We're actually at more of a loss because you're not going to be able to squeeze anything in there now. I mean, you got the one slot of 17, and then you start at 20 on up to whatever is left over.
Those 14, 15, 16 that you were mentioning that you can't go to, were those so-called white channels that got filled in with two-way radio services? Is that what happened, Eric? That's question number one.
Most of that stuff up there is police, state police, fire, all sorts of lovely public services.
Okay, right now by STA, the lowest channel we've got in the area is 51. What is the branding? What service, who is on RS-51 right?
NJTV.
NJTV. Is that what's branded as Channel 50? It's really on 51?
I think there's a Channel 50. I think, are they branded? I'm not certain what the branding is. I don't remember, actually. But the three NJTV stations, you should be able to pick up from your location.
Yeah, I pick up 50 like gangbusters, and if I look real hard, there's at least two others that I can pick up from time to time. Okay, we've taken this exciting section of the first portion of the TechNet, which is supposed to be 1 hour, and we've stretched it exactly 2.5 hours. But the material was exciting enough, and we wanted to go with the flow. So what is the mailbag like this week, John? KC2WGB. Our mailbag maven, who also monitors Echo Link, and he also monitors the chat room. He's got all those computers running, and he's got three sets of eyes looking at all those computers. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening again, everybody. Yep. Got a couple of questions. Something interesting that Eric might want to comment on, along with you, Dick. It has to do with DMR radio, and a gentleman forwarded a question. I'm trying to measure the frequency with his frequency counter. He has a very inexpensive frequency counter, and he has an HT DMR, and he's pressing it and trying to read the frequency, and he'd like to know what is the issue. Is it, he can't read anything on it, and he wonders, is it the acquisition time, the frequency counter, or is it the transmission, the style of transmission that's being used that does not allow it to be read? He'd like some information on that. If you have any information available, KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Answer that.
Yeah, I'm guessing that the way that the transmission comes in bursts doesn't dwell long enough to keep the frequency counter happy. Over to you, Eric, KE2EJ, KQRIW.
You're exactly right. It transmits 20 millisecond packets, and then it listens a little bit, and then it sends another 20 millisecond packet. If you could gate the frequency counter and have the gating time of the counter be less than 20 milliseconds, you could read it. The other simplest thing to do is transmit on an analog channel. Just put it in analog mode, so it transmits the continuous carrier, and the frequency counter, even if you got it on a 10-second gate, you're going to count it.
What I think you're saying, Eric, is that the way the DMR radio works, it has a relatively ordinary phase lock loop signal generator. And so whether the signal after that is being chopped up into 20 millisecond burst packets or transmitted continuously, the synthesizer doesn't know the difference, is my guess. Is that roughly true, Eric? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
No, you know, today's synthesizers have this amazingly fast lock up time. Interestingly enough, most of the DMR radios are built around a Texas Instruments OMAP chip, which is pretty cool, actually. It's got a DSP in it, and it's got a really fancy microprocessor. And really, it's all software, but what they do is because the output is generated digitally, we can turn it on and off pretty easily, as opposed to a phase lock loop, where in these radios we start off with a frequency standard, and it's essentially a DBS if you want to think of it that way. It doesn't have to lock up to nothing, it just is a solid reference.
But does the synthesizer operate continuously? Or does the synthesizer literally get turned off in order to create greater receiver sensitivity? Wait a minute now. You still need a synthesizer for the LO of the receiver. Maybe the synthesizer is hopping back and forth between the LO requirement for the transmit mode and the LO requirement for the receive mode. Although maybe those two functions are on the same frequency. Give me some words on all of that, Eric, about DMR. I'm reasonably low on knowledge of DMR. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
RWK2J. I hate to tell you this, but you are so stuck in the analog world. You've got to grow up. Get with it. We don't use the traditional synthesizer anymore. We use math. We have a device that does calculations of immense speed. We just need a clock reference to in which to work from. So the transmitted signal is being generated by the DSP. It's being modulated by the DSP. It's being turned off and on in packets by the DSP. So think about that.
In the military world, starting in roughly 1990-95, I've worked on direct digital synthesizers. So they're not too far in from me. But my real question is, when the DMR radio in my hand is doing transmitting and receiving in 20 millisecond packets, is the direct digital synthesizer in there creating the exact same LO frequency? No, it's not. Let's see now. One frequency is transmitting that gets multiplied, maybe heterodyned, and goes to the transmitter. During the 20 milliseconds of receive, the direct synthesizer is probably making an LO frequency for that first conversion. So I guess the possibility exists the direct digital synthesizer is frequency hopping in 20 millisecond periods. But my real question is, the frequency of transmitting of a DMR signal and the frequency of receiving of a DMR signal, are they the same frequency? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
K2LAW, KE2EJ. They can be. They can also be 5 megahertz apart. You're thinking in the traditional mode of a DDS, which is basically a lookup table. That's making a sine wave at whatever rate you decide you want to clock it out. A similar principle in that sense. You can think of it as the microprocessor, which is orchestrating whether it's receiving and transmitting based upon a number of different parameters, is sending instructions, let's say, to what you would consider to be a DDS to go from this frequency to that frequency. But in fact, in these devices, we have multiple theta A's and filters to make the output for the receiver local oscillator. And, what else did it do? The transmit multipliers. So, the actual frequency being generated out of the theta A and then multiplied up to the appropriate frequency for the transmitter, and the same thing on the receiver side, is really being handled by the CPU, which is a really fast CPU, as opposed to what you would consider to be a separate DDS. Follow what I'm saying?
To some degree, yes. All of the DMR repeaters that are on Long Island right now in the 450 megacycle region, do most of them have 5 megacycles of offset between transmit and receive? Do any of them have 0 megahertz of offset between transmit and receive? Over to you, Eric.
As I said before, I guess you missed it. Yes and yes. The repeater's got 5 megahertz between them, and when you're using a simplex or talk-around mode, you're on the same transmit receiving. All the DMR radios will operate as a conventional FM radio, too. Thank you for DSP. We don't need parameters anymore. Actually, there's a lot of math going on inside that radio. You don't realize it, but for the guy that wants to make the measurement on his frequency counter, just put it in the conventional event mode, just continually transmit as long as you hold the button down. K2RWK, good guy.
Okay, when I'm using my DMR radio in the non-analog mode, the DMR road, both a repeater and my handy talkie, so to speak, are transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency in 20 millisecond packets. Is that roughly true, Eric? Go ahead.
No, that's not true. You said on the same frequency. Repeaters have a 5 megahertz difference between input and output frequency. They're actually talking to each other in synchronization. Full duplex, if you want to think of it that way, but it really is. It's half duplex. I'm transmitting the repeated listening, now the repeated transmitting, and I'm listening. That kind of deal.
Okay, all of my analog 450 repeaters have 5 megs of separation between transmit and receive. Sometimes upside down, sometimes right side off, but 5 megs. You're leading me to believe now that all, per se, DMR radios in the DMR mode have 5 megs of offset. And although they're used in the half duplex mode, they could be full duplex if you tried hard enough. Is that true? KQRIW?
Sure, that could be done. That could be done with the radios we're using now. It means more money, that's all. At least it is another receiver. You know. Actually, there's really no need for it because that will suck up more bandwidth. The whole point of the DMR radio is to reduce the bandwidth. And because the voice is not so great, is nothing but a bunch of numbers. It doesn't have to be continuous. You can have these little holes in there, and actually the repeater transmitting back to the radio can actually say, hey, you don't belong here. I'm turning you off. And things like that can happen, too.
Yeah, this analog repeater, I'm using it in the full duplex mode, as you know. Have for the last zillion years. Almost all of my home 2-meter FM work is done by full duplex, and it saves me a lot of time. If some of my words don't come through, I know which words didn't come through, and I can repeat them. And therefore, an awful lot of the delay that would happen during a net operation gets eliminated. There are zillions of people out there running various kinds of radio nets, ham radio nets. Almost every one of them, I can describe to them the advantage of running the full duplex mode. Almost every one of them, when I do that description, their eyes glaze over. They don't hear me. They think it's too complicated. They think there's no advantage. Why should I do it? I've never done it that way. Why should I do it? I don't think of all the people that I've told that information to, I don't think I have converted one of them in the last 30 years. K2EJ, K2IW, what's wrong with that picture?
Nothing, Nick. You know, you still have to thank me for the fact that I don't put the damn delay in the theater because I know it makes me crazy. And I did make it limp through it for a little while I had it in the accepted placement years ago. Well, you try and do it with DMR, you're still freaking out of your mind. I mean, two different models of radio, the same speech comes out maybe 200 or 300 milliseconds later, or more. So, you'd enjoy that a lot.
A whole bunch of the cell phone services have got a ridiculous amount of processor delay, and therefore, if the two people talking to each other over two cell phones with many of the services, if they don't say over, so the other person knows when to talk, you have a whole lot of situations of both talking and both listening, and nobody's hearing anything. Some of them have some ridiculous delay, some of them have some ridiculous speech processing, where in the extreme case, you might not even recognize your own mother's voice because of speech processing. Back in the days when this repeater did have a delay, and I presume that delay there was mostly in order to have the time to pick out the touch tone tones. I was able to live with that delay, but it was very difficult. I think you're telling me you're keeping out the delay primarily for my benefit. Is that what you're saying, Eric? I've created that much change in the way the machine works. K2EJ, K2RIW.
That actually was a secondary reason, that wasn't a primary reason. The primary reason is the delay module is a bucket for me, and the bandwidth is like nothing to sneeze at. I mean, it's just It sounds so much better without it, so, you know, let's leave it out.
Yeah, this repeater right now is in very good shape. There's a hell of a lot of repeaters that when I go to the input frequency, the person's voice sounds all very high fidelity by comparison. What comes out of the repeater has good speech punch capability, but an awful lot of the notes below 600 hertz are gone, an awful lot of the notes above 2KC are gone. Very restricted speech, sometimes distorted. So there's a fair number of repeaters out there where if you listen to the input, boy, it's a lot more pleasant. I presume you've been through that kind of an experiment from time to time. Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, well, because I standardize on a particular type of repeater, because the audio is actually packed through a pretty reasonable DSP, it's actually a high-quality DSP, with a really good algorithm to it. We tend not to have, unless the person is at the extremes of sound is too low or too loud, which means it don't pass through the bandpass filter. We get a pretty consistent audio response. It's got a smart limiter and compressor in it. I don't have it set too high. I could deal with more, but I don't like to. I don't like to squish it. But it really doesn't bother too much in the audio. The only thing you got to watch out for is the bottom end. The filter is thinking it's, you know, the highest PL frequency is 200 something. So it's kind of rolled off at 300, and that's kind of where our speech really begins. But don't forget, if you actually let the stuff down there go through, with it? It's all right, WCK 210.
This is Delta Papa Zulu. Good evening, guys.
Good evening, good old Hal. There's another point I was going to make. I suddenly forgot it. Hal, sounds like you want to say something. Go ahead, Hal.
By the way, to the beat. Yeah, I just read the mail about, I'm very familiar with synthesizers, and I was going to give a lecture on that one of the Weimark meetings. And yeah, DDS has improved the synthesizer situation. I worked with two modulus prescalers, designed synthesizers around that. And matter of fact, I designed a synthesizer we're going to be using in the 800 channel SSD handheld walkie-talkie for 2 meters.
And now I remember what I was going to say. The speech processor that's built into a Kenwood TS711A and 811A, you press the button called processor. It does a rather gentle amount of processing, and you're hearing it right now. If I unpress this button, you're hearing me without any speech processing. And my recollection of what I'm hearing right now is a lot of the high frequency notes disappeared. And my speech has nowhere near as much punch as when I restore the processor. But the processor doesn't seem to be making any square waves. I think it's a fairly pleasant sounding processor. That's what my ears say. What do your ears say, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW.
Well, being one that has his own hearing problem, I would say it does really nicely. If you really want to make that sound nice, go get yourself a microphone with a nice big diaphragm so it makes it blow in. But it doesn't have to work so hard. What the radio guys and what interval actors are doing and how it gets the voice is going to affect everything. But when you start out with more better, you wind up with more better, even though you're losing a lot along the way.
And what you're saying is I should go out and get a real broadcast audio microphone with a good equalizer network and carefully adjust it. As it is right now, people have for years heard my voice on this repeater on the TechNet. When I meet them face to face, quite often they say, gee, your voice in real life is nowhere near as exciting. You don't sound the same. You must have some real fancy speech processing on that repeater output voice. I have none. This is a cheap handheld mic that comes with the Kenwood 711, and nothing but the speech processor button pressed in. John, KC2WGB now. We're in the middle of, we did sort of answer why the counter on DMR is going to have great trouble. I think many a counter tries to capture the signal for, let's say, half a second, 1 second, or whatever, and the DMR radio in the DMR mode is only putting out bursts for 20 milliseconds of length. So the frequency counter is saying, hey, I didn't get a chance to take a complete count, so it puts up some kind of an error signal. That's what I think is going on. KC2WGB, K2LIW, TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, I believe you and Eric are right. It's acquisition time of the counter that's responsible for the problem. And 20 milliseconds is just not enough. But okay, but that answered his question, and he's happy with that. One other thing, there's a reminder from Ridge, K2UPS. He'd like to remind us that we have a ham fest coming up, Limark, at Briarcliff, and that'll be June 5th. That's this coming Sunday. So I just wanted to drop that by, and let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next question, Dick.
Yeah, the latest issue of the Limark log has a calendar near the back. The calendar's got everything on it except that flea market, which amazed me. The June 5th flea market is not on that calendar. But everybody now knows that at Briarcliff College, they're now going to be using the northern exit entrance to the college, not the southern entrance. The southern entrance, I think, is going to be used by the sellers, and the buyers are going to be using the northern entrance. And when you go to the website of Limark.org, you will see a set of maps telling you where to go when you go to Briarcliff. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech end.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yes, I believe Jerry ZDX, he sent out a message to all the Limark members about that and how to access the proper areas, which is in reverse of what it was. Okay, I'll drop it and go on with the next question. Okay. Now this question comes in. Interesting. Never heard this one before. Gentleman is asking about waveguide, and his question is, the resistant component of waveguide, does that exist like it does for coaxial cable? You've described the waveguide and the type of wave that travels down, similar to wire, and he was wondering about the resistant component. Is it there, and how is it formed by the waveguide? So over to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Well, the questioner started off saying that there is a real resistive component called the characteristic impedance of coaxial cable. Depending on your definition, there's either a yes or a no to that. If I put my ohm meter in various ways across my coax cable, I'm going to measure something close to zero ohms. If I measure semiconductor at one end versus semiconductor at the other end, it'll be close to zero. Or shield at one end versus shield at the other end, it'll be close to zero. And if I measure semiconductor to shield, I'll get close to infinity. So the 50 ohm number, you cannot measure it with your ohm meter. However, you start off with a real RF signal generator. No, it could even be a DC voltage. Yeah. I can put a 50 ohm termination on the end of my cable. I can then start off with a power supply of any voltage that you like. Put that voltage on the semiconductor, measure the current, and I'll look at the voltage and the current, I'll divide one and the other, and I'll say, hey, voltage over current is called resistance, and I'll measure 50 ohms, if there's a 50 ohm resistor at the far end. As I go up in frequency from DC, it will stay very close to 50 ohms. There's a slight catch to that. Somewhere around the somewhere around the ultrasonic frequencies, where the depth of penetration of the RF energy going through the copper braid will give you a reactive component. In other words, you take a piece of 50 ohm cable like RG8, RG213, RG58, let me drop it. And if you think that's a good shielded piece of cable, at RF frequencies with a good braid coverage, yes. Particularly the RG214, which is a double braid, and there's an equivalent for RG-58, RG-224, I think it is. You think it's got a pretty good shield. You wrap that coaxial cable around a leaky 60-cycle power transformer. You'll be amazed how much hum pickup you get. In other words, at 60 hertz, that braid has a skin depth of penetration. That signal at 60 hertz magnetic field goes through that braid almost like it's not there. So at 60 hertz, you make a measurement of the apparent impedance of the cable. You come up with a slightly crazy number. But at most RF frequencies, you'll measure the exact same impedance across the exact same frequencies with a 50 ohm termination. You can do the same thing with a piece of waveguide. You put the right kind of a termination at the end of a waveguide, and you're launching the signal into that waveguide by way of your coax to waveguide adapter. Let me drop. And most of the coax to waveguide adapters, if you look at that exact adapter, it's got a little bit of a whisker sticking out of the center conductor of the coaxial input, which is a kind of quarter wave ground plane antenna inside of that waveguide launching that signal. Now, will that little whisker be exactly a quarter wavelength long? No, for a very good reason. Because the signal coming out of that quarter wave ground plane in the waveguide to coax adapter is bouncing off the short-circuited back wall and a little bit of bounce across the upper and side walls, and therefore it builds up a slightly different impedance. You carefully adjust the length of that probe and the position of that probe away from the short-circuit wall, and when you do it just right, you'll come up with 50 ohms of launch impedance of the coaxial input to your waveguided coax adapter. Let me drop. With the signal traveling down the waveguide itself, now you're getting into a complication. Is that signal in free space? Absolutely not. One way of analyzing the signal is that it is a free space transverse electromagnetic wave that is going down the waveguide by zigzagging back and forth, bouncing off the narrow walls. And for each individual frequency you send down there, there is one and only one angle at which every one of those bounces will take place when you're in the defined frequency region. A piece of WR90 waveguide, for instance, is 9/10 of an inch wide, 0.45 inch high, internal dimension. It's rated for 8.4 to 12.4 gigahertz. In that frequency rated region, that signal is bouncing down there with one and only one angle of bounce. There's only one mode by which that signal goes down the waveguide. Now, is the signal simply bouncing back and forth, left side, right side, left side, right side? No. It's doing both at the same time. If you look at the two bouncing signals, let me drop. You look at the two simultaneous bouncing signals down that waveguide. It's like opening up a pair of scissors at, let me pick a number, a 30-degree angle. You take that pair of scissors and you shove them down a very wide piece of waveguide. The shaft on the blade, the left-hand blade and the right-hand blade of the scissors represents the direction of propagation of each of those two simultaneous bouncing waves. That's the way the wave is down that waveguide. As such, there are specific positions in the center of the waveguide where the left bouncing signal and the right bouncing signal come together in the middle of the broad wall and give you a high voltage in that point. Now, here's something else funny. As the RF wave that you're transmitting goes from 0 to 360 degrees, creating a sine wave at, say, 1 gigahertz, if it's 1 gigahertz waveguide, which would be pretty big, by the way, that scissor diagram of the two signals coming together at the pivot in the center of the waveguide, that whole pair of scissors is propagating down the waveguide at slightly slower than the speed of light. The scissors don't sit still. The scissors are moving. Ain't that crazy? And they're moving at what's called the group velocity, which is lower than the phase velocity. There's something called group velocity. In other words, the waveguide might be a foot long mechanically. Let me drop. But you carefully measure the timing of the signal you put into the waveguide and the signal that comes out of the waveguide. The waveguide is really a foot long. Let me make it something more reasonable. Let me make it 50 feet long. And you measure the time delay. You can send the signal through air, and the signal through air propagates at a velocity factor very close to the speed of light.